When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Dalanza. In the past half a century, the nature of conflict and war has evolved significantly, not only technically, but also in the way that war is represented in photography and media. Since the Vietnam War, the way we see conflict through film, photographs, and pixels has had a powerful impact on the political fortunes of the campaigns and the way that war has been conducted. In Killing for Show, Photography, War and the Media in Vietnam and Iraq, Julian Stalabras tells the story of post-war conflict, how it was recorded and remembered through its iconic photography. Through accounts of events such as the My Lai massacre, the violent suppression of insurgent Fallujah, or the atrocities at Abu Ghraib, Stalabras maps a comprehensive theoretical re-evaluation of the relationship between war, politics and visual culture. We recorded this conversation before Russia's invasion of Ukraine in late February 2022. Julian Stalabras is an art historian, photographer, and curator and professor at the Kotel Institute of Art. And I'm very happy to say that he joins me now to discuss his work. Welcome to the show, Julian.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julian, I hold in my hand a very handsome, but also a heavy and substantial volume of writing about photography, media, conflict and war, some of which is historical, some of which is theoretical, some of which is downright technical. And I'm interested, before we get into any of the details of the book, how you came to work on these topics. You write in the book about your experience of curating the Brighton Photo Biennial at some point, and I'm kind of overwhelmed at how one can make a transition between curatorial project and a scholarly one.
Well, I'm an art historian fundamentally, and I work at the Kotel Institute of Art. So, book writing is perhaps more my thing than curation. But back in 2006, I was asked to curate the Brighton Photo Biennial, and I'd done little bits of curation before, but this was the first thing on such a scale because it was across many venues, and it was in the middle of the Iraq War. And so warfare was a lot on my mind, as on many other people's. And I decided to use these different venues to try and build kind of cumulative picture of the different ways in which photography especially was used in warfare. And the range of it as well, from amateur images right through to professional army photographers, photojournalists, long-term documentarians. And also those disreputable images that circulate in magazines and online of atrocities and blown apart bodies and so on, which were examined by Thomas Herschel with a piece called The Incommensurable Banner, which he showed in Brighton. So, so that event eventually took place in 2008. We couldn't do a catalogue at the time because the organisation ran out of money. And eventually I did produce us an edited book using many of the materials that we built together in the biennial, including lots of interviews with photographers, called Memory of Fire, which is also the title of the biennial. But I'd always wanted also to write a single authored book about all this. It seemed to me it was a very rich, difficult, and diverse subject, which had not been written about in a truly concerted way, despite the fact that, especially after 2001 and the events of 9/11 and the war on terror, all sorts of really, really interesting photographic writings were produced, and lots of new ground was broken in terms of history and theory. But what I wanted to do was to provide, a concerted account and an analysis, which also looked at where we'd come from and where we were going. And one of the things that I looked at in the Brighton Photo Vinyl through a show called Iraq Through the Lens of Vietnam was the huge differences in the media, in photographic technology, in the political background, and in the effects that images of war had on publics.
Well, you say that you're not a curator, even though I detect aspects of the kind of care and attention that you pay to in a book that might come from some of these experiences. But since you do want to identify as an art historian, I guess it's a fair question to ask you to give me an elevator pitch for the argument you make in the book.
Well, in brief, the book is about the way in which photographic images in particular are used to prosecute warfare, the way in which they can become what the Pentagon called force multipliers. In other words, you have a military force, but that military force can be multiplied in various ways, including the use of propaganda. So it looks at the field, a different field of various military images, but in particular the way in which images can be used by, well, both the Pentagon and its enemies as force multipliers to increase propaganda and military effects.
Okay, well, how do you situate yourself in this field? There's, of course, an enormous amount of literature and theory, and I imagine the archival materials that to do with the Vietnam War and the subsequent conflicts have been quite vast. So it'd be good to understand a little bit where you begin your exploration.
Yes, well, there's an unconscionable amount of literature around all these things. I believe there's something like 50,000 books written about the Vietnam War. Most of them, of course, by Americans, most of them from the viewpoint of the dominant power. So it's not necessarily a very good literature. You certainly wouldn't want to read the whole thing. and much of it, of course, also from the point of view of American soldiers. It was a difficult project, and I don't think I realized when I started it how difficult it would be. It took all in all about 10 years to write the thing. As you'll appreciate from having read it, it's a very long book, although I tried to make it, I wouldn't say an easy read, because much of what the material that I'm looking at is quite grueling, but at least I wanted to make it as clear and as accessible for a general reader as possible. But in terms of things that have been, going on and which really stimulated me, it was partly to do with new kinds of image production and new ways into photojournalism. So one might think of people like Thomas Dworzak, for instance, who was the president of Magnum for a while, and his very interesting interventions in making little books about Taliban studio portraiture, for instance, or making Instagram mind books to do with the Ukraine-Russia conflict, in fact. Assembling, social media strands, in a sense, and looking at the whole range of production, which is open on these platforms, so that you get juxtapositions of, again, atrocity images, pictures of people's girlfriends, cats and food, ruins, all of these things in a kind of rather ghastly proximity. Here, Van Kesteren would be another very good example, someone who made remarkable work, both embedded and unembedded in Iraq, and work which was always more, one felt, on the side of the civilians than the armed forces that he was sometimes obliged to accompany. But also someone who builds those things into large multimedia installations and has found new ways of showing it, and produces really interesting books out of that material as well. Or Eugenie Dolberg with her book Open Shutters of Iraq, which is a really remarkable project to a great risk to these women to train Iraqi women in the art of photographic storytelling. She did this in workshops in Syria, which was then safe, and then to get them back into Iraq and get to tell their stories. Some really remarkable views of that war from the point of view of Iraqi women. It's particularly women who have suffered more perhaps than anybody else through all of this. So there's those sorts of practices. And then alongside that, a lot of rethinking of photographic theory. Ariella Azoulay is one obvious figure that one will point to here. Ways of thinking which move beyond the sort of rather postmodern terminus that a lot of photographic theory had got into, and ways that move beyond a rather, I thought, reflex thinking which comes out of Michel Foucault and would reduce all of this to a sort of power discourse so that photography can never make any interventions, never any radical interventions anyway. Yeah, I would point to that, or Harriman and Lukate's remarkable work on iconic images and the conditions under which they're made, or Blake Stimson's work on the public sphere and on the family of man, and on what he sees as a sort of fairly brief moment, especially in the US, when possibilities are opened for humanist photography and a kind of non-imperialist global consciousness.
Well, you've mentioned quite a few thinkers, writers, and quite a lot of approaches already, and they do all make, they do all surface in the book at one point or another. And in as much as our conversation isn't supposed to be strictly an advert for your book, I do want to make it clear to our listeners that this is an incredibly impressive effort, and it is readable, bizarrely, despite its subject matter. You have 20-odd self-contained essays, which, and I think the project overall is not a challenge, but it is a successor to the ambition of something like Ariella Azoulay's The Social Contract of Photography. This is definitely one of those books that should circulate in art history departments and much further. So that's my compliment for you. Now let's go back to doing the dirty work of figuring out how we approach this vast array. Could Vietnam and Iraq be any different? And how do we even begin to understand these histories? How do you even take a step back to understand what photography and the media, but the still image in particular, which is your preoccupation here, how do we even think about that as a component to these vast war machines?
Well, maybe it's helpful to start where I started, really, which was with thinking about what happened after Vietnam and when the US military's immediate response to what became a PR debacle, in a sense, when all sorts of images started to be released into the media, which they didn't want people to see. Mm. And more than that, as the war progressed, the people started to be able to read those images in ways that they didn't want them to be read. So it's not just a matter that atrocities were shown, some very famous ones, like the burning by napalm of Kim Phuc, but that people understood that these images were part of a systematic, even genocidal effort against the Vietnamese peasantry. So the immediate reaction of the Pentagon then was to say, well, okay, we won't allow photographers into the war zone anymore. Yeah. This they did for quite a long time. But that broke down for various reasons. One was to do with the fact that after a while they couldn't control it anymore, especially as technology increased and satellite communications became easier. So it was more difficult for them to exclude photographers from the war zones. So they then moved to thinking, well, how do we control the ones that are there? And really, in many ways, not just in terms of the media, but also in terms of military strategy, the Iraq war was supposed to be the negative image, the opposite of the war in Vietnam. So it was meant to be short, focused, with really clear aims. It was supposed to be mostly done with small groups of spearhead elite troops moving very fast in a kind of blitzkrieg model. And those people were to be accompanied by photographers who were not directly censored, but because they were embedded with the military for long periods of time, they couldn't leave military protection because they lived and worked and were aided by those military units. The idea was that they would come to strongly identify with them, which for the most part did happen, and would produce a spectacular view of war, which could be used as a military tool in many ways, but one which was highly sympathetic to, you know, the US military operations. And it was a great success at first, it must be said this. First, the military campaign was a success in toppling the Iraqi regime and destroying its army. Well, kind of destroying. Many of them ran away, in part because they were seeing these images and were not prepared to fight for Saddam. So, as I say, at first, this idea of the revolution in military affairs in which all information, including media channels, were kind of focused into the war effort. I mean, a great example of this is the attack on Iraqi government buildings with cruise missiles and bombers in the opening night of the war. All it's a sort of very bloody and spectacular firework display put on for the media who were camped out in a hotel across the River Euphrates. And the idea of that, absolutely, was to use the images generated to discourage the Iraqi armed forces in particular and perhaps the regime too. And because of the speed at which these images circulated, again, it kind of worked. Most of Iraqi troops were not prepared to hang around to be slaughtered. Of course, in the long term, it all starts to come apart. And particularly as the country spirals into guerrilla resistance and then virtual civil war, it starts to look a lot more like Vietnam again. The Americans can't get out. They're stuck there, you know, being subject to continual small-scale attack. So they become a police force for a fabulously corrupt regime. And that's also a big parallel with Vietnam, which is trying ostensibly to rebuild the country, but in fact is just channeling billions of dollars into the pockets of whoever can steal it.
Well, those images are very familiar to us at the moment, but Julian, I'm going to hazard a guess that you're not that much older than me. Therefore, neither you nor me saw the accounts of Vietnam in anything that could resemble contemporaneity. But I think it's quite important to understand what it is that you are trying to do in the book for us to think a little bit about the kind of accounts that Vietnam produces in media and in photography in particular. And I'm thinking about accounts produced by both sides. So I want you to tell us a little bit about the technologies that produce these media accounts, the kind of regimes and distribution mechanisms and mechanisms of censorship that end up supporting them, and if we can already start thinking maybe about the aesthetics of those images.
In terms of the photography produced on behalf of the Western media, it fell into two main kind of groups. There was the immediate news images, which were almost always black and white and were, you know, shown in the newspapers the next day. They were rather faster to get to the news than TV at the time, because the TV tapes had to be shipped. There was no way to transmit them. So these images would be taken by photographers on sort of mini embeds, either with the Vietnamese army, South Vietnamese army, or the Americans, and then taken to an office in Saigon, looked through, printed up, and then that office would, you know, say the office of the Associated Press would have to decide which images it was going to send. Now, they had to be sent over radio, so there were wire transmissions over radio. They could be disrupted by the weather and various other events, and they could only send a few because it was a very slow process. Even if lots of pictures had been taken, they weren't necessarily seen or not immediately. And then you had feature photographers, among the most famous of the war, including people like Philip Jones Griffiths or Larry Burrows, Don McCullen. Those are the famous British ones, but there are many others, Daniel Stone and so on, who worked for the illustrated magazines, the most famous of which was Life magazine. Yep. And they could, although they didn't all, make their work in color. They would work on much more relaxed schedules. They didn't have to go back to the office every day. They could work, you know, take extended time to cover stories. They also thought less in terms of single images than in terms of picture stories, how to assemble those.
Were these feature photographers also usually embedded, or were they more independent?
Once you got accreditation, which was the US military saying you were okay to work with them, you were not obliged to embed with them. But if you wanted access to the battlefield, that was really the only way that you could do it. So you would then, you know, ride in their transport and, you know, accompany troops. But as I say, you could do other work. Philip Jones Griffiths is a good example of a photographer who spent quite a lot of time on US Army operations, but more time really with Vietnamese civilians, working with them and working on their living conditions, on the ways in which the occupation had affected them. And of course, on the, you know, the terrible impact of vast amounts of US bombing and shelling and napalm and, you know, destruction of the environment through Agent Orange and, you know, bulldozing forests, all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. Embeds were important, and the military were courted by many photographers to get exclusive access. But at the same time, it wasn't mandatory in the way that it became more in Iraq.
Well, I think it would be a shame for us to continue this conversation for much longer without tackling some of the images. And I should say that the book contains many dozens of reproductions of both color and black and white images. So it is a nice illustrated history, at the very least, of the two conflicts. So I'd like to ask you to choose an image or a couple that we could have a look at and maybe think through some of the aesthetic imperatives that determine what it is that audiences back at home end up seeing. And I'm going to paste a link to maybe a preview of one of these pictures into the show notes so listeners can check them out.
I mean, one of the most well-known images of the Vietnam War is a notorious picture of the execution of a NLF suspect. That's National Liberation Front. It's a sort of respectable term for what was often called the Viet Cong, but yeah, which is the pejorative term in Vietnam, the guerrillas fighting the occupation. So it shows the execution of an NLF suspect by the head of police, the Saigon police, in the street during the Tet Offensive in 1968. It's become so famous partly because of what it shows, which is that, you know, you are literally seeing an execution at the moment it takes place. The bullet has left the police officer's gun, it's entered the suspect's head. So the timing of it is very remarkable. And it's now often remembered perhaps more because of that than because of its political import. But at the time, its political import was quite explosive because the prisoner was bound. His hands were bound behind his back. So he'd been taken prisoner and was just shot in cold blood by this guy. And at the time, it was framed as a sort of justifiable act of revenge, although, you know, this is a very murky set of circumstances. It doesn't seem to actually be true. But this was the way, for instance, which the New York Times used to try and kind of defang the political import of that image, which was spelled out very clearly by anti-war politicians, who said, well, look, this is a clear violation of Geneva Codes of, of War. So the other thing that would have been known, certainly by many of the Vietnamese or even by Americans living there at that time, was that this guy, the head of police, Lo An, in Saigon, was in charge of this vast apparatus of torture, false imprisonment, and murder. So while this image was often in the West sort of pitched as this rather extraordinary picture of an extraordinary event, for those who were there, it was have been seen as, well, an extraordinary picture of a very common event, even at the hands of this very individual, let alone of the apparatus that he was governing. So there's a sense in which it does gear you into the wider horror of that war. And it was used in exactly that way by the anti-war movement in the United States.
That, I think, is a good introduction to really start thinking about the kinds of images that that particular conflict already produces. So on the one hand, we have the pro-war, pro-intervention PR that is still in its infancy, but it's orchestrated by the US military, the embed system, as you write in the book. So I'd like to talk about the types of imagery, literally photographic tropes, that are being exported and what they ended up doing to the US audience. And second, if that already starts happening in Vietnam, to think about the circulation of those images, but also images produced by the Vietnamese resistance, and how the Vietnamese population, fighters and civilians, react to whatever access to images and image-making equipment they have.
The aesthetics are quite variable in a way, and they have quite complex formations, I think. So you have photographers who are going in who are really coming out of the humanist tradition in photojournalism, whose photographic avatars are people like Henri Cartier-Bresson. So they're striving for, usually in black and white, a confluence of striking compositions, compositional coherence, but also coherent social storytelling, either at the level of the individual image or at the level of the picture story. And in the latter, someone like W. Eugene Smith, the famous committed humanist photographer in the United States, would be another model. So this is, it's universal, or it seeks to be. It's deeply humanist. It's very expressive. It's emotional. It's quite dramatic. Shades of black and white. You see this in Philip Jones Griffith's work. You see it in a different way in Don McCullin's work, I think. People who can really, from very difficult, uncontrolled circumstances, produce social storytelling and very striking compositions. McCullin doing so while being shot at. I mean, it's a rare talent, that. So that's one side of it. And then also, I think there's a newer way for photography. People like Robert Frank, Diane Arbus, Gary Winogrand, Lee Friedland, and others. And their work better known perhaps in the art world, but it sort of leaks into photojournalism as well. And of course, some of them start as photojournalists, where there's more questioning of that humanist basis and indeed of the compositional means that underpin it. So much more casual and off-kilter arrangements, suggestions of large empty spaces perhaps in the image, which dwarf or otherwise throw the figures in it into a sort of tension which suggests social alienation. The war was a deeply alienating setting, both for the troops, of course, who were transported thousands of miles from home, dumped, many of them conscripts, dumped into a society they had little understanding of, and in many cases were forced to debase it. And from the point of view of the Vietnamese, they understood the society, but it was changing extremely fast. There was what part of the American strategy was this huge program of forced urbanization at the point of the gun, really. And so people who had been peasants and were deeply embedded in the rural life and its rituals and religion and modes of labor found themselves living in slums in Saigon, other cities, and being forced to survive in whatever the way they could. So you get that anti-humanist or perhaps unhumanist mode of photography also applied to the description of this new, very dark, very disturbing, and in a sense, somewhat deranged social reality. I mean, if you look at the work of Tim Page, for instance, he's someone who, in part, glories in the apparatus of war, but also has a very clear idea that it's unleashed some very, very dark psychic forces, which he documents meticulously in a kind of lurid color very often, and in ways which, photographic ways, which get at some of that social dislocation and dysfunction, alienation and dread.
What kind of circulation do these images get at the time? So apart from, of course, being in the press and I presume also being screenshot and on television once in a while, do these images also circulate in the art world, such as it is at the time? Is there already a kind of clear crossover between the different spheres that might have an interest in image production?
Okay, so they circulate, obviously, first and foremost in the newspapers and magazines. Then they circulate also in the anti-war Samizdat press, some of which had like ramparts, for instance, were almost emulated life in their format. So they were quite glossy magazines. So they had quite wide circulation. And I think that's one of the big differences between the Iraq War and the Vietnam War. But there were plenty of critical images made during the Iraq War, but especially early in that war when it mattered, they weren't much published. So, yeah, they were seen, and the art world did indeed pick them up, or I should say rather the anti-war, often rather marginalized aspect of the art world.
Yeah.
People like Martha Rosler, of course, famously using those images in a photo series called Bringing the War Back Home, and many others, you know, circulating and working on those images.
Mm. Well, I'm going to ask you to speed up now, Julian, at least metaphorically. One of the things that you develop in a book is this idea of photographic speed, in which you observe a parallel between the kind of processes of technology of photography as it is used in Vietnam, being slow being a technical term that relates to film photography, and the rapid development in those technologies that mean that by the time we get to the 21st century, photography is technically a very different thing, but also, in a certain sense, photography speeds up in volume, in speed of transmission, speed of interpretation and circulation, to the extent that photography, from being this kind of reflective medium that you have just described, becomes a medium that can be understood to, in a certain sense, drive and create events.
Well, what the book tries to do is, as you say, bring together different kinds of speed and think about speed, both not only in terms of just a development from the 1960s to the present, but also the different speeds at which the different sides were moving. So I do look at North Vietnamese and NLF photography quite a bit. And those photographers will have very, very limited means. They could only travel very slowly. They certainly couldn't send their pictures by wire, at least until the very last phase of the war. And so it might well be that an NLF photographer might be eking out a roll or two of film over many months, then have to either take it or send it back up the Ho Chi Minh Trail to get to publication in Hanoi. It might only find publication a year after it was taken. So the very idea of what counts as photographic news in those circumstances is completely different from the model I was talking about earlier of, you know, daily either shipment or transmission by wire of film. So there's that, the speed of transmission and transport. There's the speed of film itself, and with digital, it's not that the basic physics are transcended, but that it becomes possible to take images much more easily in circumstances that would have been very, very challenging, if not impossible, for those using film in earlier days. There's the speed of the transmission of the film through the camera, come to that, all sorts of things. But I think more fundamentally what I wanted to look at was the speed of cultural transmission. And it's striking, as with the First World War in a sense, but with the Vietnam War too. But it was a long time before there seemed to be a settled and adequate way of depicting it, say, in film. Now, the famous, you know, Vietnam War films come quite a lot later, whereas one of the things that happens in Iraq really quite quickly is that there are pretty striking cinematic renditions. There are film series, some of them even starring troops taken from elite forces who are playing themselves, essentially. There are video games. And these things are seen quite immediately. The video games are maybe played by the troops in the field. And so you get this quite rapid sort of cycling and reinforcement of what this war is supposed to look like, you know, often in rather cliched ways. And the way in which it's supposedly conducted. So, I mean, I think that is quite new. And also the speed of reception as well is very different. I mean, we talked already about the way in which images are used as tools of war, as very fast circulating propaganda devices. But it also makes a difference, I think, when, you know, troops are able to see themselves depicted very soon after, if not immediately after, you know, those photographs being taken. And one of the constraints of embedding, not an official one, but an unofficial one, was photographers being concerned that the troops that they were shown maybe misbehaving would get to see those images and then react and throw them out of the unit or threaten them or hurt them. So, yeah, all of that changes, I think. And I think it's also linked to something that David Harvey talks about in terms of postmodern culture, which is that when you start to reach the limits that capitalism has to keep growing, obviously, to remain capitalism, and when you start to reach the physical limits of exploiting the Earth's surface or bringing new people into the workforce, colonial conquest and all the rest of it, you have to start finding methods of growth which are to do not so much with physical things, but perhaps with various elaborate forms of the manipulation of money and stocks and shares and so on, but also cultural things too, that you can speed those, especially if they're digital, and you can speed those up much faster than anything else. So this idea that there's continual growth, continual intensification, continual sort of move towards greater speed of circulation is sort of built into the very system. It's not historically contingent in that sense.
Well, you say this, but the book identifies quite a few very big, pronounced, strategically designed shifts. So one of the things that you introduce earlier on in the book is there is the revolution in military affairs. You've already mentioned this term, but it's a term that's official to the extent that it's an acronym. It's essentially a concerted effort by the Pentagon to spend no less than $1.6 billion or $1 trillion, honestly, in military terms, the number of zeros at the end of the number doesn't really matter. We're talking about the early 2000s when the Pentagon essentially has a PR operation which considers wholesale everything that it does, from the embed to virtual reality to prognosis of what the image might look like. They really think about this in a way that no branding agency would be able to do for a chocolate bar. And, you know, and we have, as a result of that, we have these kind of almost contrite examples now of this iconic footage of the statue of Saddam Hussein being toppled in Baghdad, which you point out in the book was, of course, not the kind of jubilant, spontaneous event that we were told it was. But see, that even that, to me now, seems like kind of almost trivial media manipulation. It's the kind of thing we expect. But you highlight in the book so many much more subtle but much more damning ways in which our media universe is essentially a military invention, almost as if the production and reception of media images is a military intervention and a military invention. So maybe I could ask you to talk a little bit about some of the kind of far-flung aspects that you highlight to exemplify this. You talk about war games, virtual reality, and you give examples of a couple of very strange collaborations between the military regime and the entertainment industry, which, again, on reflection, nothing strange at all, because this is the film of the movies that we watch all the time. But you talk about games like Full Spectrum Warrior, and also about some artists who engage with these things. How are we to think about these things in terms of their aesthetics and in terms of the long-term contribution to the perpetrator as an actor in some kind of a war reality?
Okay. I mean, I did an analysis of computer games way back in the 90s, and when obviously the technology was very different. But one of the things that struck me, and I guess it's pretty obvious in retrospect, is that whereas, you know, if you were watching a John Wayne movie like The Green Berets, you may or may not believe it's propaganda, but your relationship to it is quite passive. If you're playing a war game, computer war game, then in a sense you are obliged to perform and conform to the rules. Okay? You either accept the game's rules largely and play it, and do the killing that is required of you, or you don't play it. I mean, there's very little room for, certainly at that time, for non-conformity or thinking about wider consequences. So in terms of perpetrators, I thought that's significant, and it's something that the army definitely exploits. I mean, they make their own first-person shoot-em-up called America's Army. They use it as a recruiting tool. They're very aware of and exploit computer interfaces, so that you'll find that you know, some of the weapons interfaces used in the US Army resemble PlayStations. Mm-hmm. And it's not an accident because, you know, this is what they know their conscripts will be familiar with. And not only that, they actually use the technology.
Yeah, I mean, that's just basic user interface design at some yes. trivial level.
Yeah. So there's all that going on. I mean, Lisa Barnard, who's a very interesting photographic artist here, has done quite a lot of work on this military-industrial use of the gaming environments, which is not only used for training, but also, you know, rather bizarrely in many ways, for helping people to get over PTSD after they come mm-hmm. back from war zones, that there's a sort of a safe way, in a sense, of rehearsing some aspects of what they've been through.
Well, I think the safety is quite a key word, and I want us to drill down a little bit on the move that photography and media make from being a record and a reproduction and a restaging at some senses of events to what to me seems like a completely different scenario in which photography is not only complicit, but produces abuses, produces conflict, produces war. You start the book by quoting Donald Rumsfeld, who at some point says that it's impossible, or at least tiresome, to try to conduct war in front of a camera. And by the time we get to 2003, to the images from Abu Ghraib, the images of torture performed by US troops and military contractors on the enemy prison population, I kind of start reading into this an element by which the camera actually creates the torture. So there's a way in which documenting torture is, of course, a tool of warfare, but trying to think a little bit about what happens with the perpetrators of torture, I'm always inspired to think that photography eggs them on, so to speak. And I don't think this is a position you necessarily take in the book, so I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this.
I think that photography, almost since its invention, has been used for purposes which are tied up with violence and exploitation, especially with documenting victories over an enemy and the humiliation and destruction of that enemy. You might think about photographs of the communards in Paris in their coffins, mm-hmm. for instance, after the suppression of the commune in the 1870s. In 1870. So it's a long history, one which has always been pursued also by photographic amateurs, especially soldiers, right back to the First World War or maybe even before that. So in a sense, in looking at the pictures of Abu Ghraib, there's nothing very new about them. But what is new is, well, there are two things, I think, which stand out about those images. One is that the camera itself was used as a weapon of torture, or an instrument mm-hmm. of torture. This is because those prisoners were subject to blackmail threats. So when they were forced to simulate homosexual sex, for instance, they knew they were being recorded. The threat was always that, you know, these images would go get back to their friends and loved ones, that it would make life impossible for them, in essence, in Iraq. And especially if they were women, that, you know, they would be subject to honor killings and all the rest of it. So the camera was absolutely a tool of torture in that sense. I think that is new. And I think it's perhaps to do with the fact that they were using digital images and they could show these images to the prisoners, at the point at which they were being taken. But it's not as if, of course, cameras have not been used for the humiliation of prisoners long before that. I think the other thing about Abu Ghraib is that, right, these are amateur images, and normally a huge amount of doubt hangs around amateur images. It's one of the very salient interventions of Geert van Kesteren in his book Baghdad Calling, that he seeks to verify a lot of amateur images so that we can have some trust in what we're seeing. But generally, they circulate in these gray realms in which authenticity is an attribution that's very, very hard to come by. And they're often recycled, and used on both sides of a political divide, for instance. The Abu Ghraib images, because they were acknowledged by the military and became the subject of a criminal investigation within the military, you know, they're very hard to disbelieve in mm-hmm. that sense. It was very hard to cast it. There was lots of interpretative doubt cast about them, you know, whether this was really torture or merely a kind of high school hazing. So, you know, the Bush regime, you know, did its best to neuter those images in that way. What you couldn't do was just reject them and say that they were fakes, for yeah. instance. I think they were received very, very differently in the Middle East and in the US and in allied countries. In the US, obviously, they were a source of quite a bit of shock that US troops would behave in this way. And, of course, also the shock to some extent that women were involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
In Iraq, as Robert Fisk and others say, they were taken as another piece of evidence for something that was extremely well known. And it wasn't as if these were aberrations in any sense, just standard operating practice. The fact that they happened to have been recorded and then released and officially sanctioned, that's the only unusual thing about them. In that sense, there's a certain parallel, I think, with the Eddie Adams picture, with the execution picture.
Yeah. So you mentioned the problems of authenticity and interpretation. Want to ask you about your take and how you integrate the multiplicity of those kind of narratives. So Iraq, of course, is different from Vietnam in a sense that the media warfare is a little bit more balanced between the sides. It's not like Iraq has a massive media infrastructure, but we do have channels like Al Jazeera coming into existence and taking a structured and very alternative view. How do we piece all of these pieces together? Because we have the Pentagon doing its own PR. We have the media being semi-independent, but also not so independent. We have Western soldiers doing their own photography. We have Iraqis doing their own photography for a variety of different reasons. How do we take a step back and think about the nature of photography as evidence, as a testament to something that then composes history, not only because we have now so many sources at the same time, but because these sources cannot really be assumed to be independent, even of the kind of filtration and manipulation mechanism that we have already understood?
Okay, well, that's a very big question. In a sense, I hope that the book, as it stands, is a sort of answer to it, in a sense, because what the book tries to do is to take this large variety of images, not to take any of it on its own terms entirely, but to contextualize it, to think about it historically, technologically, politically, in terms of the media, in terms of military strategy, and, you know, many other elements, in terms of political constitution of the state to some extent and how it declares enemies with this, and to provide an account which allows you to see this sort of field of war imagery, very diverse war imagery, not as a unitary field, but as a competing field of different interests, I suppose, and the kinds of moves that people make within that field. So that's why, in a sense, the book is as long and as complex as it is, because it's not, you know, easy to do that. Also, it traces really a huge transformation of that field. I mean, if one thinks about Vietnam, yes, there were US soldiers using their own cameras and taking many atrocity pictures, for instance, but we tended not to get to see those because they were physical prints and, you know, they were just kept quiet and maybe hidden under in boxes under beds for a long time before relatives destroyed them and that kind of thing. A few leak out, but not much. And then you have the Western media, which we've discussed to some extent, and then you have the Vietnamese doing their images as well. Not many amateur Vietnamese, because the technology is unavailable and too expensive, especially in the North. But those images are not so available in the West. They're used a bit by the anti-war movement, and they're occasionally collated into anti-war books like Felix Green's Vietnam, Vietnam. So that happens a bit. But it's very easy not to see them, and certainly you wouldn't see them in the mainstream press. They were essentially banned, okay? Despite the fact that they're remarkable images aesthetically, technically, socially, and otherwise. I mean, they're very, very fine images, ones which would surely have found an audience if they were allowed to appear. But there was a complete ban on them, essentially. And it takes a full generation, really, over 30 years, for them to start to be the subject of exhibitions and books. So that's one thing. And it has another consequence, actually, because the Vietnamese know that their own images will not find much circulation in the press. They do things to help the Western press, and they tend to protect journalists, for instance, and photojournalists operating at the front. And very few are killed by line-of-sight weapons by the enemy. And they have an extensive spying network which runs through Associated Press and other press agencies, so they know where these people are going to be. By the time of the Iraq War, things have really obviously changed profoundly. And you mentioned Al Jazeera, which is, you know, really important, and other non-Western news outlets which can provide a different photojournalistic and video and, you know, video experience and different sorts of interpretations, and ones which are, for instance, fixed on Iraqi citizens and civilians rather than on military operations. So that's hugely important. But the other thing is that the emerging, you know, resistance groups, which are very various and, you know, fissured in all sorts of ways by ethnicity and religion, particularly tribal affiliation and so forth, they make their own media, right? And they can distribute it at first on DVD, but later, you know, over the internet as it begins to take off in Iraq. So they don't need the Western media. And in fact, they come to see the Western media, which is much more, in, you know, to generalize, much more clearly aligned with the US military and with mainstream thinking it had been in Vietnam. They see them as a resource to be exploited, either to be killed for propaganda or to be kidnapped for money. And so it quickly becomes very, very difficult to make imagery in Iraq. And the normal practice of photojournalism is more or less closed down. You know, the New York Times compound is protected by watchtowers with belt-fed machine guns on. There's no way you can go out without a huge military escort and that kind of thing. And so there's a way in which the situation becomes so dangerous that normal photographic reporting from on the Western side from Iraq almost ceases. And they start to have to rely a lot on Iraqi photographers, many of whom are very committed, very brave, and very interesting people. But it's not easy for them to work either. It's still very, very dangerous. Yeah, but that's just an example, I suppose, of that huge transformation of the image field and the way in which it fissures as well, I think. Because there's no example of that kind of hostility between the different image-making groups, I think, in the same way as in Vietnam.
Let's keep moving, though, because there is a way in which warfare continues to change its nature. So in a way that the war on warfare just changes territory, the enemy occasionally becomes rebranded, one underlying change that we do notice and that you do write about in the book is the move towards drone and aerial warfare that is the characteristics of the time of the Obama administration. So one of the things that seems to happen is that to record this kind of warfare on the ground becomes to an extent more difficult. And I guess I'm seeing a little bit of a problem for traditional media organizations in doing this. How one covers operations that don't necessarily manifest in material other than that provided by the Pentagon or the armed forces, that becomes a little bit problematic. And I'm interested in a way in which that particular moment brings war to the attention of a certain new generation of artists. I'm thinking of people like Trevor Paglen, James Bridle, or Omar Fast. So I want to ask you a little bit about the change in the aesthetics, but also the mode of production of photography as we move to the era of drone warfare.
I mean, I think it's an exaggeration to say that these issues such as drone warfare drop out of the media entirely. I mean, there are honourable people who continue to research this area, even to try and photograph it on the ground and to rehearse it, to research it journalistically. I mean, Medea Benjamin, for instance, is one of the people who've written a really good book about drone warfare and its effects on those people who are subject to it, and not just those who are directly harmed by being blown up, but those people who live under the threat that they might be all the time. There's, you know, terrible psychological effects over, you know, huge swathes of, you know, bits of Pakistan and then Afghanistan in particular. So there's that side. But I think you're right that, you know, many artists have started to do really interesting, for quite a long time now, been doing really interesting work in this area. And I suppose it's because, in a sense, that what comes out of official channels is rather poor material. It's either kept secret, entirely secret, and we don't get to see it, or on occasion when they want to declare some kind of victory that someone has been successfully targeted or whatever, you get to see a bit of rather poor quality video. So, yes, an opportunity opens for artists such as James Bridle or Irma Fast to really explore that image world and to create new kinds of ways of visualizing and feeling about this. Bridle is one of those interesting people who sort of straddles research and art practice in a sense, and, you know, offers new information as well as, you know, new ways of visualizing the drone strike issue. Fast is someone who, in that remarkable film, Best from 5,000 Feet, imagines another world in which someone more like you, the putative viewer, might be targeted by these things. And, you know, you see an American family who are blown up in their station wagon. But also, you know, with these remarkable aerial shots of Las Vegas, which, of course, is very close to where some of these bases are, out of which where the drone pilots do their work, you know, is giving you a rich and detailed and impressive and emotive vision of the drone pilot's view. So, yeah, and there are many, many other artists who've worked in this area. And it's an open field, I think, where artists can make quite striking political and sometimes research-led contributions, just because otherwise the issue is so subterranean, so the visual images around it are very poor.
Well, one of the things that artists tend to do, if I can hazard this simplification, is that they produce quite often memorable singular images that are sometimes abstractions of a certain set of ideas or certain realities. And I wanted to ask you about the role of singular iconic images in the present. Of course, your book is filled with accounts and reproductions and theorizations of many such images that have already circulated in public consciousness, have contributed in the way that we described to the production of those events in a certain sense. But do you see this kind of production ongoing? Do singular images still exist? Is there something that still comes to represent a particular event?
Yeah, my suspicion is that the occasional production of images that become iconic and are remembered collectively by large groups in the public and get published over and over again, that it may have ceased. I'm not sure, because it may be too soon to tell. You can only really know if an image is going to be iconic and last through decades after time has passed. But I think the effect of the sheer number of images, as you say, the flow of images over social media, does suggest that it's the power of the icon is fading. And I think it was even fading in Iraq, although there were some examples of professional photojournalism which looked like they were going to get that kind of traction. They're not so well known anymore, those images. And the ones that are were made by amateurs, which is striking in itself, particularly the Abu Ghraib images. Although even those, it seems to me, have been fading from public consciousness somewhat.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent the algorithm at a certain point takes over. You know, there's some kind of perversity in being the US Defense Secretary, logging into Facebook and Facebook saying, your memories from 10 years ago, remember what atrocities you were committing at the time. But again, this is not a trivial point. It deals with how the image changes its roles in the mediation of collective memories. And this is something that you devote a whole section to in a book.
Yes, and of course you're quite right that the image is no longer simply an image, but a data point among others, and with lots of associated kind of metadata carried along with it, and subject to all kinds of manipulation into individually tailored, media streams, and that in itself obviously tends to vitiate the public sphere in which the iconic image operates.
And of course, the algorithm takes us from the question of memetic reproduction to the question of memetic production itself. I'm thinking in particular about the role of memes in various forms of warfare, which you do address in the book. And this has been on my mind in particular because I've been writing a little bit about what happens in the media and the meme space of events like the Taliban's takeover of Kabul last year, which was, I think, this kind of masterpiece of media manipulation to an extent. So we saw these images of the Taliban fighters entering Kabul effortlessly, of course, and playing on dodgems in a park, going to the gym, eating ice cream, mocking up the Iwo Jima image for their own purposes. So there's a certain extent in which the media representations, having kind of gone from the control of organizations like the Pentagon, moves into a more independent sphere, possibly moves into the artistic realm, and now is just subject of this kind of media speculation and memetic reproduction. So I wonder how you started thinking about this.
The issue of them being better at it, it was obviously a question which hung around ISIS media productions as well, some years ago, that people were surprised by the polish and sophistication of their propaganda campaigns. And I think one of the things it enables us to see is that a great deal of photojournalism, as it is filtered and appears in the mainstream Western press, is also propaganda of that sort, which is not necessarily to condemn it, but I hope that one of the things that the book does is to help you to see that there are always agendas of that kind at play. If the Taliban seem to be better at it for the moment than we are, then that's not unconnected from their victory, I think, which is so striking. And I suppose that one of the hopeful things that comes out of what can be a rather bleak read in Killing for Show is this idea that American military power has failed, and not just in Afghanistan recently, but that huge apparatus of the revolution in military affairs that you describe, the vast sums that they spend on their military more generally, and the fact that their military spending, I think, outweighed the rest of the world's at one point, the whole of the rest of the world taken together. But in the end, they couldn't even hold down the Iraqi insurgency and had to get out of there. This is a vast failure. It's, I should say, the British Army covered themselves in disgrace too. I mean, not just in terms of their behavior, but also in terms of military efficacy. So, this apparatus, the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex, which was designed to fight two major wars at once, or a major war on two fronts at once, say to fight Russia and China at the same time, as I say, could not even hold on to these small countries, let alone rebuild them or anything like that. So it's a deep failure of the neoliberal state as well, in a sense, that it's the way in which it's weakened the state and state capacities and state expertise, and the way in which it is, fantastically and sort of constitutionally corrupt. All of this has, meant that it's no longer a convincing world hegemon. And, it opens a way for, obviously, a multipolar world, which may not be any less dangerous, but at any rate is not necessarily committed to this very destructive Anglo-American model of capitalism.
Well, that's a very bleak moment to Anton Julian. There's so much, so much more in the book that we haven't even begun to scratch for. Just a couple of things to mention that you cover in quite a lot of detail: the affairs of Guantanamo Bay, and the role of images there, what happens when there's nothing to photograph anymore, when, you know, how we document the kind of failure to reconstruct a state and the kind of lingering after effects of war. That's quite enough. And I just want to, again, in a small way, as an advert, recommend this to anyone who has a university library and is in the business of designing an undergraduate or indeed a postgraduate course on media theory. Incredibly impressive work. I want to thank you for it. What happens next in your own research? I hope, but I think that's a vain hope, that you're going to move into something slightly more cheerful.
It's funny that you say that. I started to get interested in cultural populism and its relations with political populism some years ago, when it seemed like a cheerier subject than it is now. So that's what I've been working on. But it won't be at least it has elements of social comedy to it, I think. and some of the artwork is very entertaining. So, it won't be like this book.
Well, Julian, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for your questions and your thoughts.
Killing for Show, Photography, War and the Media in Vietnam and Iraq by Julian Stalabras is published by Roman and Littlefield. I'm Pierre Dance, and the editor is Marshall Poe. Thank you for listening, and join us next time.